for a moment with its panicky wing beats before bursting out through a gap in the driftwood lattice overhead. A white feather came zigzagging down through the sunbeams and settled in Arlo Thursday's hair as he walked up the stairs.
Fever, I came to tell you that supper's almost ready.
Oh, I see you've found the Angel's Atlas.
Is that what it is?
That's what my grandfather called it. He used to bring me up here when I was little. He reckoned that it showed their fishing grounds, their roosts, even the currents of the upper air. You see those swirling scratches? The bird roads, he called those. Maybe we'll ride them too one day.
And this coastline, said Fever, touching the wriggly scar of it.
You can't be sure it is a coastline, you know. Birds drew these maps, and they may not have shared our concepts of east and west, distance and direction. Just because they drew Maida here, and then that shore over there, doesn't mean anything. That could be a map of somewhere farther down the coast, or in northern Africa, or some made-up country, some birdie heaven.
Or it could be America, said Fever.
Well, yes, that's what Grandfather believed. Angels have been known to travel for thousands of miles. He thought that they could easily have reached the dead continent.
But if the angels reached it, it can't be dead, said Fever. Other birds must go there. They'd take seeds with them. Plants would grow. Insects and spiders would blow there on the wind. And there are fish in the seas. Look.
She pointed to the fish shapes the angels had carved in the nooks and inlets of that unknown shore. Arlo laughed. Perhaps we'll fly there ourselves one day, when the machine is ready, and find out what you think.
Fever thought that she was being made fun of. It had happened often enough in the past, and she was starting to recognise the signs. She smiled to show that she did not mind, then got up and followed him back down the stairs of the tower, still contemplating lost America.
Perhaps it's just a taboo that stops people going there and exploring for themselves, she said, squinting into the red sunlight, wishing she could see over the curve of the earth. All those old stories about America being destroyed by the gods, a wasteland, a continent of death. We've all grown up on those stories, so we half believe them, even the rational ones among us.
Old myths are very powerful, agreed Arlo. Look at the Zagwans, burning people like you and me alive because they think technology offends their god. Or my own people. We were still sacrificing children to appease the sea goddess until a few hundred years ago. And as for you Londoners, isn't this obsession with making London move just another crazy cult? And it's spreading as fast as any religion. I gather that half the towns of the near north are thinking about adding wheels and engines.
It won't catch on, said Fever firmly. Not when people hear about your flying machine.
Ah, yes, the machine.
He looked at her, and there was an odd light in his eyes. A banked-down excitement so boyish that he looked for an instant no older than ruin.
Fever.
She's ready. There's no reason to delay any longer. If the wind stays in the west and not too strong, I mean to test her.
When?
First thing tomorrow. They went home together along a path that Fever had always avoided before. It was more direct than the winding heather mazes she usually walked up on the island's crown, but it skirted close to the cliff's edge, and the views of the white waves breaking all that way below made her stomach feel strange. However often she told herself she was being irrational and there was really no danger of falling. She walked carefully, keeping her eyes fixed on Arlo's back and the lights the sunset lit in his hair. She feared for him, and she dared not say so in case that made him fearful too. She knew that the machine should fly. She had checked and checked his figures. But the cliffs were so high, and his body so fragile.
I should be the one, she said as they drew near the tower. I should pilot it. It is only rational. I am lighter than you, light as a bird, that's what you called me. And if I crash and am killed, you would be able to build another machine.
No, he said, rounding on her almost angrily. It must be me. I want to fly, Fever. Then more kindly. Besides, if something does go wrong, like it did for poor Edgar. He reached out and quickly brushed her cheek with his rough carpenter's fingers. I'd rather be dead than have that on my conscience.
Yes, of course, said Fever, taken off guard by that touch. She felt giddy sensing the edge of the cliff behind her, the long drop into the surf. But Arlo only smiled at her and turned and walked along the path away from her. Angels hung above him in the evening air on their big wings, almost motionless. And it was easy to imagine him up there, soaring among them, as if the sky was where he had always belonged. Chapter 22. Jonathan Hazel investigates. For the first few days, Jonathan Hazel thought that matters had improved. Something had taken the wind out of Dr. Teal's sails, wiped the smile off his face, and generally made him far easier to live with. He was still treating the house on Rua Penhasco like a hotel, letting himself in and out at all hours, but he was no longer quite so boisterous about it. He no longer sat himself down at the harpsichord to tootle out Abidonian marches at 3 a.m, or rearrange the statues on the shrine into amusing dioramas. He didn't shout, "Morning, Hazel!" every day, in that big, booming voice of his when Jonathan Hazel came creeping downstairs after another rough night in the guest room bed. Didn't scatter his drawings of the wretched funiculars all over the house and get ink on the rugs. Indeed, he seemed to be out most of the time, and when he was at home, he scarcely spoke. But after the first few days, his guest's gloom started to oppress Jonathan Hazel almost as much as his cheerfulness had. What was troubling the fellow, he wondered. He sensed that, as London's envoy at the World's End, it was his duty to find out. He would not want Teal sending a bad report about him back to his new mayor, Quercus. The engineer looked at him darkly when he asked what was wrong over breakfast one morning. Looked at him darkly and then shook his head. "It's a bad business, Master Hazel." "Well, may I be of any assistance?" "I doubt it." Teal poked half-heartedly at a kipper, then glanced up again. "You remember I had you send a courier to London the morning after my arrival?" Jonathan Hazel remembered it well. It had cost him a small fortune, and Dr. Teal showed no sign of paying him back. "The message he was carrying concerned that girl Fever Crumb," Dr. Teal continued. "She is important to some very important people in London. Important enough that I felt sure it would do me no end of good if I could only persuade her to return home with me when I go. But she has vanished." "Vanished? I thought that theatre of hers had cleared off to Merriam or somewhere. Do you think I don't know that, Hazel? She remained behind, and she has vanished. The hotel where she was staying has no knowledge of her. When I went to the home of a man I thought she might have called on, I found it empty, no sign of either of them. She has fled, or been kidnapped. I will have to confess to these important Londoners that having found Miss Crumb, I have lost her again, perhaps for good." "Dr. Teal," said Jonathan Hazel, pushing away his own kipper, half-eaten, "this is terrible." The engineer nodded grimly. "Indeed it is. My career may never recover from this blow." Jonathan Hazel frowned. He remembered Fever Crumb standing in sunlight on his doorstep. He was afraid that he had been rather rude to her. She had struck him as a sensible young person, sensible and very charming. Who cared a fig for Dr. Teal's career when the poor girl was missing? "We must find her," he said, thumping the table so hard that he startled himself and made all the cutlery jiggle. "Eh?" Teal looked up at him, surprised. "Well, what do you think I've been trying to do these past days? I've been walking around and around this unreasonable city of yours like a fly in a toilet bowl, looking for her high and low." "But you haven't found her." Jonathan Hazel was starting to feel strangely excited. He had thought for a long time that he needed a new hobby. He had been considering building a model of Maida out of matchsticks. But might not a spot of investigation be just as diverting? He had always enjoyed a good puzzle. He said, "You should have told me as soon as Miss Crumb went missing. I am London's envoy, remember, and I have a great deal of local knowledge at my, fingertips. I have contacts and things. If anyone has heard of Miss Crumb's whereabouts, I shall learn of it. I shall start at once, this morning, at the Exchange. Where was she last seen, Dr. Teal? What was the name of this gentleman you think she may have called on?" Dr. Teal looked doubtfully at him. He was used to working alone. He could think of no more unlikely partner than this meek little mole-like man, and yet the situation was desperate, and Hazel's suggestion was not irrational. His name is Arlo Thursday.
Thursday? But there was some sort of disturbance at his funicular a few nights ago. I heard it said at the exchange that the Octopus Cartel was involved. If they have kidnapped poor Miss Crumb.
Dr. Teal just looked glumly at him. Jonathan Hazel finished his cup of tea and set it down on the saucer. He stood up.
I shall look into this, Dr. Teal. I shall look into this at once.
And looked into it he had. The trail had led him from the rumour mills of the exchange, through harbourside coffee shops and low-end chandleries, up into the slums of Muro d'Oeste, where the refugees from Zagua lived. It was as he had guessed. People who had been wary of talking to a bumptious stranger like Teal were quite prepared to share what they knew with Jonathan Hazel, a familiar merchant who was known for his honesty and tact. None of them had actually seen Fever Crumb, it was true, but he had learned much that was interesting. Who would have thought that he would make such a good detective? On the same evening that Fever found the Angel's map, he met with Dr. Teal in a funicular bar on the Rua Serculo to report his findings.
Honestly, Hazel, said the engineer,
as Jonathan Hazel sidled up to him in a shadowy corner.
Why can't we discuss this at home? We're not spies.
Jonathan Hazel looked quickly over his shoulder to make sure that no one was listening. What he was about to say could have been said just as easily at home, it was true, but he didn't get much chance to arrange clandestine meetings in bars as a general rule, and he wasn't about to let this one slip through his fingers.
I have made progress, Dr. Teal.
What's that?
Speak up. In my investigation, firstly, the chandlers tell me that young Arlo Thursday has been placing orders for certain materials in recent months. Wood, tools, glue, and great quantities of paper have been delivered to his funicular.
And what do you deduce from this? Asked Dr. Teal wearily.
Why, Dr. Teal, I deduce that Thursday has been building something. He is Daniel Thursday's grandson, after all. Perhaps he has finally given up on the kites and toy birds that won him such a strange reputation and started making something of more practical use. A new kind of ship, perhaps. It may be that your Miss Crumb, with her background as an engineer, was helping him. And it may be that the Octopus Cartel got wind of this and tried to steal it from him.
He paused. He was pleased to see that Dr. Teal was attentive now, leaning forward slightly, his eyes watchful and oddly lightless.
Most convincing, Hazel. Do go on. Well, said Jonathan Hazel carefully, trying not to get ahead of himself. At first, what with those two thugs who were found at Thursday's funicular, I was afraid the Octopus might have succeeded. If they had captured Thursday and his new ship, who knows what might have become of Miss Crumb? She could have been murdered, or sold as a slave to some cruel Zagwan princeling. But I do not now believe that is the case.
Why not? Asked Teal.
Because when I started asking after her, I was frequently told that other men had been asking the same questions a few days previously. It did not matter whether I asked at the exchange or some grubby chandlery, the story was the same. Someone had been there before me, and when I dug a little deeper, I found that these other men were employees of Fat Jargo. And when I dug deeper still, I was told that it is Fat Jargo who handles all the octopus's business here.
And who is Fat Jargo?
Shh!
Jonathan Hazel looked about again. A man like Fat Jargo could have spies anywhere.
Fat Jargo Belkin, he whispered. Only the most important businessman in Maida. Only the richest man west of Thelona. He has a huge villa on the southern coast and a charming wife. It is a great shock.
Dr. Teal refused to be shocked. And what makes you think that Fever isn't locked up in this charming villa, a prison of Belkin and his huge wife?
No, the villa is huge, the wife is charming, and the fact that Belkin has been asking after Miss Crumb tells us that he does not know where she is. Do you see?
It tells us that he did not know. But if he has stopped asking, perhaps he has found her. And if he doesn't have her, where is she? We're no further on than we were when you first stuck your oar in.
Ah, said Jonathan Hazel. That brings me to the second strand of my investigation. I have learned something about Arlo Thursday's house. Local fishermen who know all the ins and outs of Maida's shores tell me that there is a hidden cove on the southwestern side of the island. When Daniel Thursday lived in that funicular, he used to keep a boat there. I believe there must be a path leading through the crater wall from Thursday's garden down to this cove. That must be the way that Thursday escaped after he gunned down those two octopoid gentlemen. Doubtless he took Miss Crumb with him. They have escaped by sea. If only we knew where they were making for.
What about the Racket Isles? Asked Dr. Teal. Didn't Thursday's family have shipyards there? Could he be holed up there?
Oh, no, said the merchant. Those shipyards were swept away by the great wave. The Ragged Isles are dead. Bare places now. Cursed, the locals say. It's far more likely that Miss Crumb and the boy would seek shelter in Merriam or nowhere. We should send at once to those cities and see if there have been any sightings of them.
Dr. Teal said, This is excellent work, Hazel. I could not have done better myself.
Tell me, in your delvings, did you hear any mention of a man named Lowther Vishniac?
Jonathan Hazel looked blank.
I can't say I did. Who is he?
The engineer shook his head.
No one.
Just a name that I heard mentioned once. I merely wondered.
But if you have not heard anything of him, we may reassure ourselves that he is not in Maida.
Chapter 23. Test Flight. Arlo had always planned to call his new machine the Thurzer. Through all the months of planning and hard work, it had never once occurred to him that it should not be dedicated to her. It was as beautiful, as delicate, as precious as his Thurzer, and he liked to imagine how she would look when the news reached her. Not only had a miraculous device alighted on the lawns behind the Quadrado de Mar, it was named after her. Fat Jago Belkin might have given her pearls and diamonds and fine dresses and a house the size of a small town, but Arlo would make her a present of all tomorrow's skies. But when he woke on the morning of the first flight, he knew that was not the right name after all. The picture of Thurzer Blasi that he had carried in his mind all these years had begun to fade, like a painting hung on a sunny wall. She was still there, but she seemed less real. Maybe she had never been real. How many actual words had he ever exchanged with her? A few hundred? Maybe not that many. He rolled over in his bunk and looked across the big bare room to where Fever Crumb lay sleeping. She always went to sleep flat on her back, which she claimed was healthier, and as far as he knew, she always woke up in the same position, still with her hair tied back in that tight bun, which must be as hard as a pebble under the nape of her neck. Arlo grinned. When they had first come to the island, he had sometimes thought how much he would rather have had Thurzer Belkin there with him instead of this bony, stubborn, cold-natured Londoner. But now that the machine was finished, he could see that Thurzer would never have been able to help him as Fever had. He could not imagine debating lift-to-weight ratios and angles of attack with Thurzer. Nor could he see Thurzer planing a propeller blade for 6 hours straight, or wearing, without complaint, the same grubby clothes day after day, and washing only in the sea. Slightly surprised at himself, he decided that Thurzer did not deserve to have her name on his machine. He rose quietly and went up onto the roof. And by the time Fever awoke and joined him there, he had already painted the new name he had chosen on the machine's nose. She frowned when she read it. Goshawk. It is irrational to give a name to a machine, was all she said. Eastward, behind Maida, the sun was coming up. But in the west the sky was still dusky, the ocean almost colourless. A cool breeze from the west, salt-smelling, hummed through the goshawk's rigging. Together, using mallets and hammers and their bare hands, they demolished the parapet on the tower's windward side. Then Arlo pulled on his goggles and tied back his long hair and clambered into the harness that was slung beneath the trembling paper wings. His hands grasped the levers that operated the wing flaps and rudder. "Wish me luck," he said, as Fever went around to the back to start the engine. "Good luck," she said obediently, although she did not believe in luck, only in engineering and the laws of physics. She reached up and gripped the edges of the propeller they had made, and found that her hands were shaking, which annoyed her. Surely Arlo was the one who should be afraid. But she did not see him trembling. He just lay there in the harness, as if he were a part of the machine, as if he were a new-fledged angel spreading its wings on some shelf of the sea cliffs. She swung the propeller as hard as she could, and it whirled into a blurred disc, scattering shadows over the wings and the tower roof. The clumsy engine came to life at last with a hard, throaty roar that shivered all the struts and cables. Then she put both hands on the bar that Arlo had mounted below the tail and used all her weight to shove the machine forward into the wind. It went off the edge of the roof, seemed to hesitate for a moment, dipped its wings and plummeted.
"No!"
she screamed, the scream lost in the angry shout of the engine, which echoed from the cliffs and the tower wall as the goshawk plunged downward. She ran to the roof's edge, with that dreadful feeling of watching something fall and being helpless to save it. But the machine saved itself. Before it hit the rocks, its nose lifted. The engine roared and whinnied as it scrambled up the sky, and Fever was kneeling on the roof, watching it fly away above the beaches, wiping the silly tears from her face and feeling glad that there was no one there to see her. Alone in the sky, Arlo eased up on the rudder lever and felt the goshawk respond, veering to the right. He drew back on the wing controls and tried to make her climb. "I'm flying," he thought, wondering how he could nail this moment into his memory. He wanted to keep all of it, everything, every last shadow in each ripple of sand on the low-tide beach below him. The noise of the engine battered at him, its echoes reflecting off the cliff faces. The curious angels whirled all around him, circling the machine, an honour guard welcoming him into the realms of the air. He saw Weasel among them, crossing and recrossing the machine's path, heard his cry above the engine's roar.
"Arlo!"
But he was too heavy. He could feel it each time he tried to go higher. A sluggishness, the grumpy tug of gravity. That big engine mounted above him was upsetting the delicate balance of the wings and spoiling all his careful mathematics. It was a struggle to keep the goshawk's nose up. Engine fumes blew in his face, smearing his goggles, stinking of castor oil. He had planned to circle the island and land on the long flat strand beside the quay, but he was barely halfway around, and already he had dropped almost to sea level. Rocks rushed by just beneath him, exposed by the low tide, spine-breaking rocks with skirts of bladder wrack and black barnacled backs as friendly as cheese graters. He saw sand ahead, a long stretch of wet sand under wet black cliffs, and he steered for it as best he could, already feeling a little sad that the sky did not want him after all. The harness punched him in the breastbone, knocked all the air out of his lungs, flung divots of sand stung his face, clogged his mouth as he gasped for breath. The machine bounced and took flight again, rushing along a few feet above its own shadow. A ripped-off wheel bounded along beside it for a ways, drawing a line across the beach. He saw a rainbow hanging in the fan of spray that it threw up behind it from the wet sand. Then there was another thump. Sand between his teeth, salt water, his hip banging painfully against a strut. The crunch of snapped wood, paper tearing, a line of rocks sliding toward him sideways. It took her an unbelievably long time to reach the place where he had fallen. She scrambled over breakwaters and barriers of wet rock, clattered across deep drifts of pebbles, pulled off her shoes and pelted barefoot along the shining sand. The flying machine stood on its nose, surrounded by inquisitive angels. Spilled fuel slid in rainbow-coloured ribbons down the little streams and runnels of the beach toward the sea. Arlo was still dangling in the harness, caught there upside down. He was laughing, and as she struggled to unstrap him, she thought he must be delirious. Perhaps too much blood had run to his head in all the time he'd hung there, waiting. But she helped him down and set him upright and slapped his face a couple of times, and he went on laughing. He was just happy. "I flew, Fever, I flew!" Fever stepped away, because he showed a definite inclination to hug her, the way the Lyceum actors sometimes did after a good performance. She did not want to be hugged by Arlo Thursday. She did not know where it would end. His laughter slowly wore itself out. He pulled his goggles off and wiped his eyes. There was a small cup beneath one of them. "You were right about the engine," he said. "We shall need a lighter one." Fever shook her head. "That isn't possible." "You could make one," he said. He had flown. He felt all things were possible. "I bet you could make one even better than Edgar's."
"Out of what?" Fever complained. "I haven't the materials or the tools. I have no idea how to make an engine that would be light enough. And even if I did, what would it run on? Half our ethanol has spilled away. You will just have to make the Goshawk bigger. If it had a broader wingspan, perhaps it would be able to lift the engine."
"No." Arlo sat down on the sand, sobered. The angel swooped to and fro above him, dropping echoes of his spent laughter like bombs.
"Ha ha! Ooh, ooh, ooh!"
He traced shapes in the sand for a moment. Wings, letters. "No, we haven't the time. We haven't the wood. We haven't the paste or the paper. We must have another engine."
"But I've already explained."
"You don't need to build one." He looked up at her, shading his eyes with one hand, smiling so happily that she wondered if he was still delirious. "We already have one. Right here on the island." Fever thought for a moment.
"The Aranya?"
"Why not? Your grandfather's gift to mine. There's some engine inside it that doesn't seem to need fuel."
"All engines need fuel."
"Then maybe it has a limitless supply. If we can get it out and use it to drive the Goshawk's propeller, we'll have solved the weight problem."
"But we need the Aranya. What if Belkin finds us? Or Vishniak?"
"What if they don't?" asked Arlo. "They haven't yet. Why should they now?" He stood up, brushing sand from his clothes, shaking it from his hair. He had been in the sky, and he was not going to let his enemies stop him from returning. "Fever, we've almost done it. Powered, controlled flight. We can't let fear of Belkin and Vishniak stop us now." They spent the rest of the morning dismantling the Goshawk and moving the pieces up above the tide line before the sea returned. In the afternoon, they carried it all back piece by piece to the tower, reassembling it on the roof, while the Aranya hopped on its endless, eerie sentry duty among the overgrown keys below them. At about the age when most children were learning nursery rhymes and how to count to 10, Fever had been taught the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Dr. Crumb said that everyone should know them. They were the key to understanding so much about the universe. The name made them sound complicated, but they were really quite simple. The first law said that energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only change its form. The second, that entropy increases in a closed system, which Dr. Crumb explained meant that hot things, if left to their own devices, cool down. That heat only moved from hotter places to colder ones, and that machines could never be completely efficient. So where did that leave the stalkers? Reanimated corpses, armoured and mechanised, powered by technology from who knew when. They burned no fuel as far as Fever had ever been able to see, and they had been known to keep going for centuries. So either they must be making their own energy somehow, which broke the first law, or they were charged up when they were made, and the charge kept them running forever, which broke the second. A technomancer Fever had talked to in Bruges claimed that they drew power from the air by harvesting invisible electric fields, but she suspected he was only guessing. Her mother, chief stalker builder to the movement, had mentioned something called molecular clockwork, but she had not been able to explain it, and it sounded like voodoo to Fever. It was a mystery. And as she followed Arlo down to the shipyard in the evening sunlight, she looked forward to learning more. In the alleyways between the ivy-covered ruins, Arlo called the machine's name softly, like someone calling for a stray cat. And after a few moments, it came to them, hopping out through a hole in a wall, with the sunset winking on its spines.
"Careful," said Fever. "You should have seen what it did to Fat Shargo's thugs and the front of your house."
Arlo ignored her. He held out his hand to the Aranya. It hesitated, then seemed to understand and came closer, swivelling its blunt body from side to side. Fever saw the gun jutting out of its underside, the metal around it darkened and made iridescent by the exhaust from the muzzle. She saw other details that she'd never noticed before, having never been so close to it in daylight. The rims of small inspection hatches set into its flanks and belly, the pistons at the joints of its legs shining sleekly with oil.
"Come here," said Arlo, as if it were a pet.
It hopped close to him, and he deftly popped a hatch open and drew out a glittering ribbon of brass-cased bullets, lifting it into the sunlight as carefully as a barge-town swami handling a snake. The Aranya just stood there, patiently waiting. He took out a screwdriver and started undoing screws all around the carapace. Fever caught them in her hands as they fell. When there were 12 cupped in her palms, she put them down carefully, on the ground, and she and Arlo, between them, lifted the whole top of the carapace off. A stink of chemistry and must escaped into the air. Fever looked inside the Aranya and saw a mass of wires and ducting wound around and through the featherless carcass of a long-dead bird, all cupped in that metal shell. Mechanical tendrils sprouted from the angel's skull and from dozens of junction boxes anchored to its spine. A cat's cradle of wiring, more complicated by far than the one she'd created under the Lyceum stage. Beneath it all, a doughnut-shaped contraption buzzed. Cautiously, she put her hand close to it. It felt as warm as an egg.
"That's the power source. Look. It's wired into everything."
"Behold the doughnut of power," said Arlo.
"But what is it?" asked Fever. "We should be careful. If we start unwiring it, it might explode and take us with it. It might make another crater as big as Maida."
But Arlo was already at work, with snips and tweezers detaching the magic doughnut from the machinery it had powered. He did not care what it was. If it could keep the Aranya on duty through 3 generations, he should have no difficulty carrying the goshawk back into the air. As he started to lift the doughnut free, the Aranya jerked into motion. Swift and startling as a spider, it took a step, turned, poked out its gun like a long black tongue. Something inside it went snick, 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 like a sewing machine. "The power source is no use on its own," said Fever, wincing with disgust as she snatched a spanner and delved in past the threshing angel in its nest of tubes. "We'll need the drive mechanism too." Together they wrenched out the doughnut, along with a fat electric motor. There were sparks, a spell of burned wire, and the Aranya jerked rigid and toppled backward. Fever jumped out of its way, just in time to stop herself going with it as it pitched off the edge of the quay. The splash rang off the ruined walls. The Aranya sank away from her into the greenish water, down into the shadows cast by the wavering weeds, the darting silvery fish.
"Pity," said Arlo.
"I was going to try to salvage the gun, too." Cupped in his brown hands, trailing severed cables, the weird power ring buzzed like a maybug. Nothing that Fever knew about engines could help her understand the object they'd taken out of the Aranya. It was high old tech from the deep past. She didn't even know a name for the pale metal it was made of. It had no need for fuel and no visible moving parts, and yet it was clearly producing energy, and even wasting a little in the form of that beetly buzzing and a faint warmth, until she discovered a square pad on its underside, which, when pressed, seemed to shut it off. Arlo wanted to call it the doughnut, but Fever thought that sounded undignified and insisted on the torus. Fever thought they should try to prise it open and see what was going on inside, but Arlo shook his head.
"We're here to build an aircraft, not to study this contraption. Besides, what if you were right? If we start trying to get inside it, it might explode or poison us. You hear sometimes of scavengers being poisoned by old machines. Their hair falls out, or they puff up like bladders."
"If we don't know how it works," said Fever, "we'll never be able to make another."
"We won't need to," said Arlo. "The important thing for now is to get the Goshawk airborne so we can show the merchants of Maida that it really does fly. Once we have some money behind us, then we'll build bigger machines capable of carrying a real motor."
They laid the torus on the floor of the tower, arranging its spaghetti of wires around it like the legs of a jellyfish they were getting ready to dissect. The wires were sheathed in plastic, with little terminals of the pale metal at their ends.
"It's like a battery," said Fever, wishing again that she still had some of Goshawk's memories.
"Look, this red wire must be a negative pole, and this black one is positive. Or perhaps the other way round. Either way, we should be able to form a circuit."
Arlo nodded encouragingly, but Fever could tell that he did not understand. She fetched Edgar Saraband's engine, which they had not bothered to mount again aboard the Goshawk. Opening the heavy cowling, she studied the parts inside.
If they were to lose the fuel keg and all those unsightly ducts, she could house the torus there and use the motor to turn the gears and power the reduction drive. A pity the Aranya had sunk. It would have been a useful mine for the materials she would need. But Arlo's toolboxes were well stocked, and she was an engineer. She thought that she could do it. She told Arlo to bring wrenches and screwdrivers and set to work dismantling the old engine.
Chapter 24. Drowned Offering. At the foot of the cliffs in a corner of the Belkin's beach, Thirza kept a sacred tide pool. She knew that it was silly, but the Maya Bajo had been so much a part of her childhood, and it made her feel safe and childlike again to perform the age-old rituals. So she had had a priestess from the temple come to bless the pool, and Fat Jargo's architect had designed a pretty little copper-domed temple with driftwood pillars to shelter it. And each day, if she was not too busy, she came down to make a little offering there. She was kneeling at the pool's edge, watching the green and purple weeds wave in its depths, when Weasel found her that afternoon. He came winging low over the wave-tops and settled beside her, calling her name, full of excitement at having flown with Arlo. When Thirza returned to the house, she was shaking a little, and her dress was wet. She went to find Fat Jargo, who was reading in the garden room. "The fruit is ripe," she said. "It's time to shake the tree."
"You're sure?"
"Arlo flew this morning. Poor Weasel told me all about it. He was very excited. There was a lot I didn't really understand about Arlo and the Crumb Girl and a big crab, but the important part was clear enough. Arlo has finished his machine, and he flew all around the island in it and landed on a beach. Flew like an angel, apparently." Fat Jargo set his book aside and levered himself up out of his chair.
"Excellent. I'll cross to Thirsty Island tonight. Prepare a letter for the cartel. We'll send it as soon as I come home with the machine. What about that bird of yours?"
"Oh, I have dealt with him," said Thirza, as carelessly as she could. Her husband came closer and saw the state she was in, the small scratches on her hands, and the seawater dripping from the hem of her dress.
"Poor Thirza," he said, and held her close.
She had drowned Weasel in the tide pool. It had been horrible. She had had to hold him under with both her hands, and it had taken much longer than she had expected for the life to go out of him. Water had splashed everywhere, and his little fingers had clutched and clawed and scrabbled at her hands. It had made her sad, but she had no further use for the angel now. And if she had let him live, there was a danger that he might fly back to the island and let Arlo know what he had told her. Anyway, he would be her gift to the goddess. The Mai Abajo was usually content with wine or coins these days, and never asked for human sacrifices any more. But at a time like this, with such important business to be conducted, it could do no harm to offer her a life. While she changed out of her wet clothes and Beza dabbed ointment on her scratches, Fat Jago made his preparations. He sent messengers running into the city to tell the captain and crew of his galley that they would sail on the evening tide. He took off his gold-embroidered house robes and put on some clothes Thirza had given him especially for this expedition. A sturdy canvas jacket with dozens of useful pockets, dark blue barragan breeches, gaitered boots. She thought he looked splendid when he emerged from his dressing room. The brass buttons that secured all the pockets glinted and winked in the evening sunlight, bright as new gold coins, and he had changed his diamond scalp symbol from red to a nice nautical blue. She fetched the packet of sandwiches that she had made for him and slipped it into one of the pockets.
"I wish I could come with you," she said, smoothing a crease out of his collar.
"It's no place for you, my sweet," said Fat Jago. He knew there might be violence and unpleasantness ahead, and he liked to keep Thirza free of such things, in a separate compartment of his life. He kissed her goodbye. "I'll miss you."
"I'll miss you, too."
When his sedan chair had departed for the harbour side, she went back down the garden to the beach. Angels were flapping and cawing around her little temple, striping its roof with their poo, wailing over the bundle of dirty feathers that washed to and fro in the pool between the driftwood pillars.
"Shoo!" shouted Thirza, flapping her arms at them. "Be off with you!"
They lifted into the sky like wind-blown newspapers, still wailing. A half-hour later, Jonathan Hazel stepped onto the little balcony outside his study. He had dispatched messengers to Nowhere and Merriam that morning, and Dr. Teal had been pacing the drawing-room ever since, waiting for them to return with news of fever. Jonathan Hazel had busied himself with all the letters and receipts and bills of lading that he had been neglecting during the past few days while he played detective. It never ceased to astonish him, the way such paperwork heaped up. Standing on the balcony, he started to notice that there was some sort of confusion going on among the angels. Alarm calls racketed across the rooftops. The big birds were flying in crazy circles over the harbour and executing wild manoeuvres between Maida's chimney stacks. He shivered. The idea that he shared this city with intelligences that were not human had always unsettled him, no matter how dim and amiable the angels were. He could not help but find this strange behaviour ominous. He had often heard his Maidan friends recall that the angels had been the first to raise the warning when the great wave came, the Onra del Mai, rolling in like a judgment from the western deeps. He glanced toward the harbour mouth and the open ocean beyond. There was no sign of a wave. But he saw something in the outer basin that concerned him almost as much. He stared for a moment, then ran inside the house.
"Dr. Teal! Dr. Teal!"
He dragged the engineer out onto the balcony with him and pointed at the harbour.
"What are we looking at?" asked the engineer. "That red ship?" "That is Fat Jago's galley, the Desolation Row," said Jonathan Hazel. "She's been towed into the outer basin. She must be making ready to sail on the next tide."
Dr. Teal looked again, and this time Jonathan Hazel could see his mind working. For all his bumbling, the engineer wasn't stupid. He may have had word of Thursday and fever. His taking that ship to find them and bring back Arlo's machine.
"Of course, it may be some other matter," ventured Jonathan Hazel hopefully.
"A man like Fat Jago must have many matters of business to attend to."
"Believe me," said Dr. Teal with sudden startling earnestness, "none of them will be more important than Thursday's machine."
"Machine?"
"His boat, ship, whatever it is that he's building. We must get aboard that galley, see where Fat Jago is going to."
"Oh, no, 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 no," said Jonathan Hazel. "Fat Jago's men will see us. I mean, they will see you.
But how else can we find out where they are bound?
and get there first and ensure Fever's safety.
Believe me, Dr. Teal, I am as concerned about Miss Crumb as you. But to try and stow away aboard the Desolation Row would be madness. He blinked a few times, looking from Teal to the distant harbour side, where tons of water were being rolled into the galley's holds. Madness, he said again, and then, I have a little boat of my own. It will take a big ship like Desolation Row several hours to make ready and get out of the harbour. In my boat, we could leave at once.
For where?
Nowhere or Merriam?
Merriam, said Jonathan Hazel firmly. It is most likely that Miss Crumb has gone where her friends are, and once we are out of the harbour, the wind will be with us running down the coast.
Once they were out of the harbour, but that proved more easily said than done, for there was no wind at all inside the crater that evening, and Jonathan Hazel had to row his boat the whole length of the outer basin, while Dr. Teal sat in the bow and fumed.
"Come on, Hazel!" he snapped as they drew level with the long red blade that was the Desolation Row. Lanterns had been lit on her high stern castle, and her crew was busy removing tarpaulins from a boxy structure near her bow, which turned out to be a revolving gun turret.
"Look!" said Teal. "They'll soon be ready for the off. Still, it's good to see that your friend Fat Jago is as wary of the sea goddess as every other fool in Maida. No engines on that ship of his, just oars. She can't be very fast."
"Oh, she'll be fast," panted Jonathan Hazel. "Fat Jago employs a great many oarsmen, and she'll not be prey to the winds as we are. We must just hope she will give us another hour or so, a sporting start."
But their luck was out. Just as they passed the lighthouse at the harbour mouth and felt the first stirrings of the wind, they heard the faint, steady pounding of a drum coming up the harbour behind them. The Desolation Row swept out of Maida in the twilight under bare masts, with her oars dipping and rising like the pistons of some implacable machine. Teal and Hazel watched her come, her sleek red hull like a bloodied knife, with dim lights burning in her gunslits and that big lantern bright on her stern. Her lookouts mistook Hazel's boat for a night fisherman, maybe. Or maybe they were so intent on their business that they never noticed it bobbing there at all.
Boom! Boom! Doom! Went the drum inside her,
and the white water wavered like a ghost against her ram, and the little boat pitched on her wake as she went past it and swung her prow toward the last band of golden light that lay along the western sea.
"West!" said Dr. Teal. "They're headed west! Hazel, you idiot! You were wrong! They're making for the Ragged Isles."
"But there's nothing there," insisted Jonathan Hazel.
"Well, Fat Jago seems pretty sure that there is. You don't launch a monster like that on the off chance of finding something."
"What shall we do, Dr. Teal?" The engineer looked grim, and one hand reached inside his coat. There was something in there that he kept feeling for, as if its bulk and weight reassured him. Since he was an engineer, Jonathan Hazel suspected it must be something more practical than a lucky rabbit's foot or a copy of the Meditations of St. Kylie. He patted it now, glared at Hazel, and said,
"Follow them, of course."
Jonathan Hazel raised the sail. It might have been russet, if there had been any light to see it by, but in the deepening twilight it was just a rhomboid of deeper darkness against the sky. It flapped for a moment until Jonathan Hazel scrambled aft and pulled in the mainsheet, whereon it filled with wind, causing the boat to heel and rush forward and making Dr. Teal say angrily,
"I thought you knew how to sail this thing."
Jonathan Hazel ignored him. The tug of the mainsheet in his hand was comforting, and so was the cheerful gurgling of water under the boat's foot, the slap of the small waves as she cut through them.
"She's a good boat," he said, "a fast boat."
But she was not so fast as the Desolation Row, whose stern lantern was already dwindling in the west, racing toward those far-off islands that pricked the black horizon like fish's teeth. Chapter 25. The Landing Party. They had worked all afternoon, pausing now and then to eat ship's biscuits and slices of cheese, but never stopping for a meal. They had forgotten to feel hungry or tired.
Sometimes one or other of them would take a break and walk away from the tower. And once Arlo went to the beach to swim. But their heads were full of their work all the time, and they soon came back to the machine. They felt that they were close to something. To stop before they reached it was impossible. By sundown, Fever's new engine was complete. With the Arania's Taurus at its heart, it was as light and delicate as everything else about the Goshawk. As the sky above the tower grew dark and filled with stars, and the angels went ghosting homeward to their roosts, Arlo lit a lantern, and Fever helped him fix the engine into position on the machine's back. Carefully, they made it fast, boring holes through the struts and bolting the engine to them, tightening the nuts as far as they would go. Instead of the medieval armour that Edgar Saraband's engine had worn, Arlo made a tortoiseshell basket of Balsa's struts, and they pasted paper over it and varnished it and fixed that over the mechanisms. The Taurus gave off so little heat that Fever didn't think it needed any vents to cool it, but Arlo made some anyway, just to be safe. They looked like the gills of a dogfish. And then, when the newborn sickle moon hung high over the islands, they switched it on. It buzzed restlessly, and the propeller quivered, and when Fever gave it one helping turn, the big wooden blade dissolved suddenly into a circular blur of motion. And they felt the Goshawk trembling, straining at its tethers like a live thing, a huge newborn bird that longed for the freedom of the sky. When they turned it off, the night seemed quieter than before, the air more still. The breeze had died. Fever said, "I hope the wind comes back tomorrow. We cannot launch without a headwind." "It will come," said Arlo, watching her, laughing privately at that busy brain of hers, the way it never rested. 5 miles per hour would be ideal, but I suppose we can manage with less. He said, "You never unfasten your hair." "What?" Fever put a hand to the hard bun at the back of her head. "What does that have to do with anything?" She wondered if he was thinking of using her hair as some sort of pennant, so that he could gauge the speed and direction of the wind. Surely his own was long enough. "Even when you go to sleep," said Arlo. "Sometimes a bit comes loose, but you always tie it straight back." "Hair is irrational," said Fever. "It is a vestige of our animal past. I had to grow mine when I left the head, just to stop people staring. But that does not mean that..." Arlo came around the Goshawk's tail and stood close to her. He reached out and she felt his fingers busy at the nape of her neck, unravelling the careful knot she'd tied. She knew that she ought to protest, but when she tried to speak, no words came out, just a little sigh, a little gasp. And then the knot was undone, and around her face in wisps and strands, her dry, sun-bleached hair came tickling down. He combed his fingers through it, arranging it for her, his hands brushing against her throat and her ears, and the angles of her jaw. "I do not approve," she started to say, but she could not remember what it was that she did not approve of. She touched his face, tracing all the beautiful patterns of his freckles, thinking, "This is not rational. I am forgetting myself, but might it not be pleasant to forget herself for a little while? Might it not be pleasant to give in to these fierce and hungry feelings?" The smells of Arlo's body flowered in her mind as sprays of nameless colour. She supposed that she was falling in love. That was what Dimphna or Lilibet would call it. And although she knew it must just be a matter of chemicals and instincts, it still felt wonderful and frightening and strange. She leaned toward Arlo until their faces touched. "I am supposed to kiss him now," she thought, thinking of all the love scenes she had watched through her periscope from her lair under the Lyceum stage. "I wonder how kissing works." White wings flared above her in the moonlight, and an angel came down and landed heavily on her head.
"Weasel!"
it squawked, pushing its fish-stinky beak down between their startled faces as they sprang apart.
"Arlo! Weasel!"
Fever batted it away, and it fluttered wildly and settled on the Goshawk's port wing, still screaming out a mess of squawks and words. She wondered if it was angry at her for touching Arlo. Then she saw the look on his face.
What? What has happened to Weasel? How?
Tsa-tsa,
croaked the angel. Fever thought it was the same female she had tried to talk to about the scratches in the bird castle. It hadn't many words or much understanding of how to put them together, but it kept trying until Arlo understood.
She drowned him?
Tsa-tsa.
A cold feeling came over Fever.
What was Weasel doing anywhere near Tsa-tsa?
Tsa-tsa,
said the angel, doing a little agitated dance along the parapet.
Friend! Snacks!
Does Weasel talk to Tsa-tsa often? Fever asked.
Often. Yesterday.
Arlo shook his head. Yesterday might mean last month or last year. Weasel wouldn't betray me.
Weasel wouldn't know he was betraying you, said Fever. Not if she was nice to him and gave him lots of snacks.
Tsa-tsa wouldn't, he started to say. And then more angels were around them, their voices clanging like rusty bells around the old tower.
Arlo! Floaty boat! Big! Big! Floaty boat! Come!
Arlo and Fever turned from each other, looking out across the sea. Beyond the reefs and shoals that screened the island, a ship rode the starlit swell, long and low and black, with light showing here and there. Fever stared at it, trying to understand what it meant. She could not believe that it was anything good.
Floaty boat!
Cried the angels.
It's Belkin,
said Arlo, with a catch in his voice, as if he were going to cry.
That's his galley, the Desolation Row. It was built at Blazes the year I started there.
But it'll never get through the reefs.
Not even if Weasel told Tsa-tsa about the waymarks, asked Fever.
Arlo looked at her. No, she's too big. She'd rip her keel out on the rocks.
Little floaty boat,
screeched the angels, taking up a new cry.
Big floaty boat, come! Little floaty boat, come!
Arlo looked confused, but Fever, with her keen, scriven eyes, soon saw what they meant. A smaller shape was detaching itself from the black outline of Fat Jago's galley, a skiff already starting to thread its way through the reefs. Faint sounds came to her across the water, the dull wooden clunk of a banged oar, a distant curse. She took Arlo's hand and felt him trembling.
Weasel told Tsa-tsa about us, he said. And Tsa-tsa told Belkin everything.
Arlo, said Fever, it is irrational to cry over spilled milk. Can that boat get through the reefs?
The big ship certainly couldn't, not by night, but maybe a skiff.
He made an angry gesture, scaring the angels away into the dark. He looked very frightened. Fever had the feeling that came to her sometimes when she was with Ruin and Fern, a need to protect him against the hard truths of the world. She decided to take charge.
We'll launch the Goshawk. Fly to Maida now.
I'm not leaving you behind, he said.
Perhaps she'd carry us both with the new engine.
Never. The balance would be all wrong. Anyway, there's no wind. She'll never lift in this calm. He was right. The night was still. The air as quiet as the air in a big room. The voices of Fat Jago's men and the creak of their oars carrying clearly across the water.
They can't come up here unless we let them, Fever said. There's only one way in, up that ladder.
They'll have guns.
But they won't want to use them. The Goshawk's no use to them if it's full of holes, nor are you. We can hold them off.
What with?
Where's your pistol?
It's not loaded.
It never was.
Fever snatched the lantern and ran to the hatch and down the stairs, looking desperately around their cluttered quarters. The belt of bullets that Arlo had taken from the Irania's gun shone faintly, abandoned under the table.
If only we hadn't dismantled it, Fever thought. The Irania could have kept a whole fleet from landing.
But regret would not bring it back any more than it would bring back Weasel or undo his treachery. She snatched up the bullet belt and studied the brass cartridges. On the base of each was a raised disc, which she guessed must be some sort of percussion cap. A mechanism inside the Irania's gun would have struck that, causing the charge inside the cartridge to explode and force the bullet down the gun barrel. Ingenious, but useless. since the gun itself was several fathoms down in the old dock. "What about the angels?" she asked, glancing around as Arlo came down the stairs. "Would they help us?" He shook his head. "They'd be too scared. It's not their fight, anyway. They probably wouldn't even understand." "They don't understand much that we do. That's why Weasel thought it was all right to tell Furtzer about us, I expect."